Welcome to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, your weekly dose of Porsche culture. With Tech Talk, Heritage, the Ren Builds playlists, along with a massive dollop of waffle, we'll keep you entertained. So subscribe now on any podcast streaming service and YouTube. Welcome to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, and welcome back to another episode. This week's episode is going to be all about cam manufacture. So cam manufacture, they basically designed, so Mickey, the guy that sort of the founder of cam, designed a fully carbon fiber 912. 912s are fascinating to me for the obvious reason that they use a four-cylinder engine, not a six-cylinder engine, air-cooled, lightweight carbon fiber. All about driver enjoyment, and that is what the Ren 550 will be when it eventually gets designed and delivered. So there's for the last 2 years, at least 18 months, I've been trying to get hold of Mickey when he's been in the country to basically drive the car, but also actually to sit down and have a conversation. So that's coming up. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about some of the other things that are going on, particularly the next set of episodes that are going to be shot, and a little bit of what I've been up to this last week. So back when I was at Brooklands, talked to Lockton Performance Insurance. Now, insurance, I hate doing it every single year. Comes to the same thing again. I start groaning. And then you speak to the current insurance provider, and they probably offer, you know, a bulk deal if you put two or three cars together, if you don't have a commercial license for insurance or commercial insurance connections. So you end up in this weird sort of situation of trying to get bits and pieces sorted out. It takes forever. It drives me nuts every year. And when I was at Brooklands, Lockton, no, it was before that actually. It was when I was at Summer Sundown with Porsche Club Great Britain, and Lockton are affiliated with PCGB, and they came over, loved my car, which is always a good start to talk to me, but also then said, actually, we could probably help you out with some of that stuff. So there's going to be an episode that, although probably sounds a little bit academic on the surface, it's something we've all got to go through, and the chances are, if you're listening to this, you've got a Porsche and it's probably modified, and if not, you're planning to modify it. And actually, what better for me to just fire a load of the questions that you guys will probably have, the same ones I've got basically, and give them a load of scenarios, work through it, get sort of indicative costs, things for me particularly that are interesting. My Cayman, my 981, is obviously very heavily modified. And if I was to have an unfortunate situation happen, there's zero chance a standard insurance company would offer me the full value of the vehicle. I'd end up in that hot again, pretty common standard thing to sort of discuss. Horrible situation where you're trying to prove to the insurance company that your car's as worth as much as it is. Ugh, the whole thing stinks. But Lockton were actually really good. This isn't an ad, by the way. They are going to come on the podcast, but I don't currently use them, so I'm not getting any kickback off Lockton. But what they were saying to me was fascinating. And I do want this to be, as much as it can, be a sort of independent kind of bit of feedback. And I learn as you learn, and then we kind of all hopefully get some benefit out of that as well. So I'm going to invite Lockton on. So that's probably going to be back end of this year, if not early next year. Another episode that's coming up, or that's to be booked, so this isn't going to come out anytime soon, but it's definitely on the cards. The I Love You Man episode that I mentioned it last week, I'm sure. By the way, I'll just interrupt this. Although I pretty much live in the moment with these intros, right? So I will go off on tangents, talk about all sorts of bits and pieces. I never make any notes about what I said the previous week. So if I end up repeating myself, then don't judge me, because it's literally done all on the hoof. The only bit that is a lot of time and effort goes into is actually the main part of the podcast itself. So, but these bits, don't judge me if I'm saying the same thing again. Anyway, I'll get back to the point. Caffeine and Machine, I Love You Man, Rob Dickinson, and the big talk with Phil McGovern, who owns Caffeine and Machine, and Rob. Rob loved my car, signed the underside of the hood of my car, and somebody that was there at the same time that chipped in at the same episode, if you want to call them episodes, is a chap called Ricky. Now, Ricky, hello if you're listening to this. In fact, I'm pretty sure you will, because he said he binge listened the entire set of podcasts up until now, which is very kind. we're going to sit down and have a chat about engine building, because guess who builds the Singer DLS engines? This guy. So we're going to get an opportunity to sit and talk about all of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes from his perspective as an engine builder for the Singer DLS. So that's going to come up in a forthcoming episode. Again, there was a guy, what I do, and this is semi-frequent, is when I'm at shows, and obviously for this particular year, I've been at almost every show that's been available, keep my eyes peeled for really cool cars and then chat to the owners. And if there's a bit of a story there or something that's really interesting, I quite often say, do you fancy coming on the podcast? I get some yeses, I get some noes. But there was a guy that had a collection of cars. This was at Bicester months ago now. And I won't go into the specifics of his actual car, but it ended up being, the story was ridiculous. Came over from the States. I'm not going to go into too many details because it's, I don't want to spoil the episode for itself, but we're going to go and do a shoot with him. Kind of get more into cinematic videos for YouTube. So the full kind of conversational piece will still be there for this, but what we won't be doing is trying to put all the full conversation out on YouTube. The YouTube will be about, we'll have bits of that interspersed with great video as well. So the audio will be on here, the video will be on there. So that's coming up. Talking about Cam, actually, when Mickey, and he does say it in the episode actually, comes back to this country, and they were off to Monterey literally the week after Boxing Gas, that he's when they bring either a client's car over that they're able to test or do some more press, I'm gonna get opportunity to drive one of the 912s, whether it's the T or the C. It doesn't really make any difference to me. I just want to get in and see what those cars are like to drive. So, and the bringing up to kind of more recent times then, so the Michelin event at Piston Heads, which was last week. Was it last week or was it the week before? I can't even remember whether it was last week or, yeah, it was literally last week. So it would have been the day after the episode went live last week. That was an amazing event, and I will all credit to Michelin. Did a fantastic job of putting that on. Smith and Smith, again, I would hazard a guess that you guys listened to that podcast as well with Johnny Smith. They were doing a live episode there, which was really cool on the stage. There was an auction at the same time, and then just a huge littering of really cool cars. So yeah, there's loads of cars that I would have absolutely put my own money into that weren't Porsche at Bicester Motion. Actually, one of the things I did do is I took a minute to go and look at the building fire, where the building fire was, and just pause and pay my respects to the poor people that lost their lives there. I mean, they've done a good job of kind of working around that building now being kind of obviously an unsafe place to be. But I just thought it was, you know, the respectful thing to do given the circumstances, to just go and take a minute. It was my first time back there since they had the fire. It was awful. But there was also a guy that I was on the Michelin stand with called Matt, quite popular on Piston Heads. If you've seen the threads on Piston Heads where it's knackered Porsche with, and then it's with no roof or with jacked up suspension or with, and I can't remember what the 906 one is as well, but with loads of miles, that guy is an engineer by trade, and he has done an incredible job at basically re-engineering different platforms, and the car he brought with him that day was a Boxster 986, but with an Audi 20 valve turbo engine in, which seems like a strange thing to do, and even I was a bit like curious about it. I'd known about the car for a while, but I was curious as to why that engine. And again, I want to let him talk about his experiences and why that engine, and the value proposition that it offers basically, and how he did that. Because again, I went from kind of within the first 2 minutes of being a little bit skeptical, why would you replace a six cylinder with a four cylinder, through to the end of it completely understanding why. And I won't do a good enough job of explaining it that you would buy. I'm pretty sure of that, again, because most people that listen to this podcast, I know from having spoken to quite a few of you, you're six cylinder through and through. But hold your horses. The guy's fascinating. He's a lovely chap. So, and we got on like house on fire. So we're going to talk to him as well. There's a guy, there's a few people on Facebook, on Facebook groups that I've seen fascinating projects pop up. There's a whole thing at the moment about rebodying cars, which is obviously of interest to me. And there's some, there's a 356 that's basically the carcass of it is available, but the chassis number, the V5 in this country is long gone. And they're putting a 718 body, chassis effectively, and put the 356 body on. I want to get a hold of that guy. So Peter Lamb, if you're listening to this, I'm going to reach out and see if I can get you on the podcast, because, you know, again, what a fascinating, agree with it or don't agree with it, I would imagine there'd be a hardcore 356 contingent that will kind of be rolling over and crying at this point. But if you got a basically a nothing, you know, at best it would be a bitzer. I completely respect the ideas, or at least the attempt to make it something really cool out of it. So there's that. So one of the other cars that, and the people that I spoke to at the I Love You Man episode, he's got a kind of mock-up GT2, really cool car, obviously, but also really good friends with Nakai-san of RWB fame, and had, you know, fairly strong views, because he's friends with Nakai, about RWB, what it stands for, what it's there to do, what it's now not there to do. And I have my own opinions about RWB. I don't love the workmanship. Again, I've not stood and watched a build in front of me, but it's hard to kind of defend, you know, silver tape or foil tape and, you know, folded back bits of metal. But that's my own opinion, right? And I like debates and I like challenge. I also really like the guy that I'm going to be bringing on the podcast. He's agreed already. We're actually going to do a swap, so he's going to drive, not permanently, he's going to drive my car, I'm going to take his GT2 rep out, and then we're going to go and have some fun, then have some beers and talk about RWB. So that's coming up in a future episode as well. And lastly, there is a fascinating young lady from the States that's developed an art car, 986, and it's based around fairly famous art that's out there already. Again, I don't want to give too much away, because I like these things to kind of feel organic and you learn in the moment. Completely understandably, and this happens very frequently, people don't necessarily feel like they've got a story to tell, but then 2 seconds into having a conversation you realize they absolutely have. So there's just a bit of time to sort of see if they still want to do it. I've encouraged them and they've said yes, but then, you know, time goes by. This has happened lots and lots of times where people have considered coming on the podcast and then not been completely sure. And I've tried to, again, I'm not here to make anybody look bad. I always want people to feel like they've had a great experience. And I've made some really great friends out of this podcast, as I said last week. I do remember that bit. So yeah, there's lots to come in terms of episodes that they're arranged or partly arranged, but they've not been shot yet. They won't come out until next year. The ones that are in the bank, though, are in the bank. They're going through the works at the moment, and they're all going to come out in the next kind of 6 to 8 weeks. So this season four, that's what's all going to come out in the next sort of 6 to 8 weeks. And then this lot will get shot and recorded and then come out next year. I'm going to try and do them in like 8 to 10 sets if I can, because it's a manageable amount for me to get through without having never-ending kind of backed up, you know, bits of content to kind of work through, because it's so time consuming. If you've got any feedback though, you can always give me drop me a DM on at the Rengineering podcast, or send me an email, info@rengineering.com. And if you forget any of those, rengineering.com is the website, and you can just find me through there anyway. What I want to talk to you now about is a bit more about cam. So yeah, 912, completely full carbon fiber body, 699 kilos, 182 brake horsepower. I mean, this it's dependent on how you view things. Coming from a Lotus background, for me, that's the recipe for a good time. If you are of the mindset that all you want is huge power, and that's all you care about, and you don't care if it's, you know, 2.5 tons, but it's got 1,000 brake horsepower, you're probably not going to appreciate these cars, but then that's okay too. There's something for everybody. I've got, literally, you might hear the crackling in the background, because I've got the brochure in front of me. an A, amazing art and photography. I love it when someone puts tons of time into something like this. But what I found fascinating about the chat with Mickey is that he comes from Hungary, the Eastern Bloc. And what comes across massively is that actually it's the challenge behind someone's life experience and the lack of available options that drives innovation, which means you then go after the kind of non-obvious options. So when you think about Hungary in the 80s and 90s, it's not kind of the Hungary you might visit now. And even to Mickey's kind of guidance, really, Hungary even now still has some time to catch up with, you know, with what we think is the Western world. So there's a lot, I'm tiptoeing around that because I don't want to offend anybody. But yeah, this is you'll hear this in the podcast itself. You know, Mickey's talking about his childhood and growing up and some of these cars. And it's fascinating because what it's done is it's kind of put him in a situation where just doesn't rely on the obvious. And then what you've got out of that is this 912 that's sub 700 kilos with interior, with, you know, it looks like a completely ordinary, you know, 911 silhouette, which it's only really when you get into things like, oh, right, it's got completely carbon fiber wheels. All the panels are carbon fiber. The interior, while it's got an interior, is incredibly lightweight. You know, it's all of these sorts of things that you kind of get like the heads up of, right, this is not somebody that's kind of approached a 911, you know, bolted some ST arches on, not there's anything wrong with this as well, but, and then stuck a hoofing grate engine in the back. It's a very thought through, deliberate kind of approach to how you would build a car that no one's approached in this way before. So that's why I was interested, you know, 2 years ago when I first caught sight of this thing. That's why I've chased Mickey down the day before Box and Gas Megaphonics 2025. So here are some of the bits of feedback from some of the press that have driven the 912 so far. So Autocar, it's a Saturday morning thrash up a mountainside canyon road to a coffee shop sort of car, immersive like a Caterham. Classic Porsche, throwing the cam into corners, there's no twitchiness, the car feels completely planted at all times. Considering the high quality of workmanship and exotic materials on display when compared to other recently announced Porsche Resto mods, the Cam 912C is offered at a reasonable price point. Piston heads, real effort has been put into ensuring the driver's relationship to the gear stick is right, that the shift is good and the gearbox itself is tough enough, and really shows. As a reminder of the pleasure to be derived from engines and gearboxes, you'll not find much better. Car magazine, minimal weight and just enough power is something that journalists and engineers are always banging on about, and it's a lovely car to drive that exemplifies that approach. Top Gear, this is a serious bit of kit and feels every bit the updated 1960s racer that its creator was aiming for. And finally, Evo unlocks the 912's potential. So Cam unlocks the 911, fuck's sake. Evo unlocks the 912's potential and evolves it into something different without losing its essential character or turning it into a caricature. So pretty compelling reading and pretty compelling feedback from the press. And here is Mickey from Cam Manufacture. I'll see you back at the end. Welcome back to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast. And Mickey, thank you for joining me, especially last minute.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. All of these episodes typically have the same flow, but it's not like a set. I don't have a set of questions or anything like that. They're already natural and open. But I start, before we get on to Cam and 912s and carbon fiber and all the rest of it, I want to sort of find out a bit more about you as a person. So let's wind the clock back to you as a kid. Where did cars come in, mate? Was it like you were born into the world and then suddenly you had a car toy? Was it something that came a bit later? How did that happen?
So I wish I would say I was born in it, but no. My dad is an engineer. I think that's the closest what I can get to a car or okay. Machines in general. I always loved machines, in cars in particular. So I grew up in Eastern Europe, Hungary. Mm. So before the 90s, that was a totally different world. So we didn't have that much variety of cars, mostly socialistic cars, rarely.
Yugos and things like that? Was it that stuff?
Oh, Yugos, Trabants. We had a Trabant, right. Which I kind of admire still. But all sorts of different socialistic cars. And sometimes, rarely, you would see anything from the Western Europe, but mostly just not the particular interesting cars. Maybe a 123 Mercedes or maybe Beetles. Beetles were kind of, you could see them on the streets. And Beetles were my closest, what I would say, to a Porsche I could in
well,
my childhood.
Well, it's the Genesis, right?
Yeah, that's the Genesis. And I always loved the Beetles. I remember when I grew up in a suburb of Budapest, not so far from where we lived. There was a red, orange, tangerine, whatever you say, faded red Beetle, 1300, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I remember the sound of it, you know, the flutes, that whistling when it started with the flutes on the boxers. And that got me. That totally got me when I was a kid. So I was always a car kid. For me, the present was just a Matchbox or Lego. Yeah. That was the two things that you could choose from.
Yeah.
And then growing up, it was a bit of a different thing. So around my parents' house when I was already in elementary school, fifth grade, I started working in a garage in the summers.
How old were you then? So elementaries?
Elementary five.
Single figures, really young.
And I just simply, because, you know, I was bored in the summers. My mom wanted me to do something.
Go out of the house.
And there was this garage where they had like interesting cars. Well, she didn't know about that. But it was just the closest place to us.
Yeah.
And the owner of the garage was nice. The guys who worked there, they were cool. Like, yeah, sure, come on. Why not? You can be around. So interestingly, it was a very interesting mix of people working there. So the youngest guy who did the body part, he was a Beetle guy. He converted and made all sorts of different Beetle conversions in the 90s. Mm. So I think that
the wizard stuff and the kind of the
it's all sorts of weird shit.
Beach buggies.
So this is the 90s in Hungary, Eastern Europe. So you get whatever you can get to. And I think at that time he had a convertible that it was a chopped convertible. So not original convertible.
Yeah.
He made it like white fenders. The steel wheels were turned around. V6 Ford Granada engine in the back. Skoda gearbox, which was a 5-speed because the Beetle was just 4-speed. You know, all sort of things that you could find.
Yeah.
And he was rallying and rally crossing. And then the other guy, he was in go-karts. So he was building all sorts of different, you know, motorcycle engine go-karts. Yeah. And the guy who was leading the whole shop, he used to be an ex-DTM engineer.
Oh, wow. That's even better.
Yeah.
Do you know what I like about that little story on its own is the fact that you've got people like you would be an influence right from the start to not leave things alone, not to be scared of picking stuff up, breaking it apart, trying something new, because that's what you were surrounded with, guys that were kind of trying anything, right?
Absolutely. So inherently, I got into these people where the guy who was running the shop, he had the Skoda MB1000, which itself is a beautiful car from the socialistic era. Rear engine, perfectly balanced. It's really a great car. One of the best cars from the 60s, 70s. And he started to modify it. So, you know, obviously he didn't have the means to get a Western car. So he souped up the engine to a 19 horsepower Favorite engine and then ignition and then fuel injection and then suspension and then wheels and so on.
Yeah.
So he kind of enjoyed that he was beating the shit out of the cars that were much more expensive, and he obviously knew how to drive as well. So it was kind of cool that I was surrounded with these type of people, and also we had a lot of race cars.
Yeah.
So the Toyota Celica GT4, we had Skodas, Rallycross Skodas, we had Peugeot 205 Rally. That was kind of one of my favorite cars, the 1.3 Rally.
Oh, I love it, the French one with the twin carbs and the little arches, yes, the white arches, left-hand drive only.
But they were a beautiful car and so light and nimble.
So
cool, so much fun. There was
we're inspired by the same stuff, right? The 100%.
I guess so. HF Integrales. We started with the 8 valve and then we had the 16 valve in the shop. So, you know, all sorts of very weird, interesting. Vauxhall Astra GSI. And again, like very, very wide range of different cars. And I really enjoyed that. And I had the chance to really learn on these cars. The first car that I had to work on my own, it was a burnt out Beetle. So I had to do the rewiring of it.
Wow.
So I guess...
How old were you then at this point?
Probably 11, 12-ish.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
So that was...
Six-volt probably as well?
That was already like 12 volts.
Was it 12 volts?
It wasn't that complicated. It wasn't totally burnt out. It just some white... So it got fire, but... some wires, you had to redo it. It wasn't that kind of clamping, basic stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not that I'd had to do it on my own, but you know, it just simply, they were looking, overseeing me, but that was a simple task and you could do it.
Yeah.
And no, anyway, so I've learned a lot of stuff. So that's where I've learned the skills to, you know, feel around cars, fix up stuff. So after that, I never really got scared of anything doing it.
And at the same time, your dad was an engineer, right?
So, yeah.
Okay, so what kind of engineering was?
Well, he's a refrigeration engineer.
Oh, okay, cool.
So, but in generally, now his main business and work is designing food processing plants. Wow, so breweries, dairy plants, all sorts of like, you know, food processing plants. That's what he's doing mainly in his own business. So that was my, let's say, childhood. And then high school got a bit different vibe. I still, you know, cars were always my passion, but I grew a different passion. It was a creative industry, photography and videography.
Interesting.
So my profession originally is a film producer.
Ah, okay.
So I've been in...
Is this why your content is rock solid? Are you still doing some of this stuff? Were you?
Well, we do it. Yeah,
do you?
Of course.
Why?
Yeah, it's so
good.
Thank you. I mean, obviously, these are the things like, you know, the design, the website, the branding, all
that
stuff. It's
so important, right?
It's important. And this is the closest that I can get the resource to it.
Yeah.
And the packaging, you know, the message, the story, how you put it out. That's, I think it's probably the key importance. By the way, we have a brochure. We have a brochure. I'll give you a new brochure.
Yeah, do.
Can you bring us a brochure? Never mind. And so, generally speaking, during high school, I started approaching this creative direction.
Mm.
And I started a school TV.
Okay.
We had a studio, we had cameras.
Yeah.
It's the era of VHS, SVHS.
So I
started editing on two recorders.
So, cool.
Ground
roots.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Analog editing and storytelling. And then I think the last year in high school, that's where we got the first computer where we started doing editing.
Yeah.
And then this is what college came, but already before college, I started doing my business.
Yeah.
And then that was basically my main focus. And then after a few years, I had different cars. Like I always liked cars. But I never really explored, you know, getting into the cars the way that I always imagined.
Yeah.
I think once the closest I had the Beetle, a new Beetle.
Yeah.
A 1.9 TDI. And then I tuned the shit out of it. It was always like, I exploded like three turbos on it.
Yeah.
So the classic.
Crank the boost.
Smoke and charm. You know, that's the TDI message that I had. I think that was the craziest from the cars that I had. And then I spent a year in New York studying and working. And I sold my car and everything. So basically, when I returned, I didn't have a car. And I think that was the moment in my life. I said, that was it for the modern cars for now.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And this is the period where I'm going to start with classic cars.
Yeah.
I probably watched too much Wheeler Dealer. And I've got the confidence that I can deal with this
besides work
and everything.
Thanks, mate. Thank you.
And... So
I don't know if you had a chance to listen, but I literally shot an episode with Mike Brewer three months ago. Yeah, lovely.
So
guy,
tell him that it cost me a lot of money.
I will. I'd love that.
So first impression that it's very light. And I got really lucky with my first car that I did.
Okay.
It was very easy and simple task. And I grew a lot of confidence that now I can do anything. If I did that, this is easy.
Everything's possible.
Everything is possible. So it's a trap. They should tell that. There should be a disclaimer in them.
Should at the start before, of every episode.
Every episode.
We cannot be responsible for what you do after this.
Yes. So there should be. So tell him that.
I'll text him afterwards. Literally tell him.
Anyways, but it was a huge influence for me.
Yeah.
And really getting the confidence to start that I always wanted to start. That's for sure, 100%. So without those shows. SOS car, that was also another one.
I think that's
a bit more legit in a way that they show more of the process.
Yeah, for sure.
How they do it, and probably over there it's a bit more realistic in terms of you see what's done on the car and how complicated some situations are.
Yeah.
But both shows are very influential. So regardless, I got a Range Rover two-door from Spain. A few people know, but that's my passion, Range Rovers. Any Range Rover, but particularly the two-door.
Such weird, they're cool cars, don't get me wrong, but why?
Yeah, amazing cars.
Why Range Rover? Why, especially like the earliest? I mean, they are cool, but...
Because I like the shape, I like the boxy shape.
Yeah, okay.
I always love that, you know, lights, the headlights, the simplicity, although it's not that simple.
Which car designer was it that said you should be able to draw any car with three lines, and that if you can do that, then you're on the right track?
I don't remember who said that, but in general design terms, I think simplicity is always the most important thing.
Yeah, for sure.
And if you look any generation of the Range Rover, they always look fine. Mm. It doesn't matter if you're buying the oldest one, the newest one, any year, even now, you put it out on the street, you wouldn't look old or used or bored or whatever. You could see which period it's coming from. Mm. But it's fine. It's just fine. It's not like, you know, like let's say that Focus. It's white goods, but it's dated. And in a few years, it's going to be very dated. Mm. But the Range Rovers are always elegant. And
you know, we've lost half my audience now. They're like, oh.
I know. I'm sorry.
I'm just joking, mate. It's all good.
No, I'm saying. So that was the first car, by the way. So I got it from Barcelona. Mm. And the other influence, Top Gear. So these long road trips. So you get a car, like you got a cheap car, a beater, and then you drive across.
And you send it, mate. Full send.
That's what we did.
Nice.
2,700 euros. That's what I paid for the Range Rover. Jumped into the airport and drove back.
Very cool.
Obviously, it broke.
How far was it leaking?
I think in the first 10 hours, our generator broke. It wasn't that bad, but it was Friday and it's Spain, so.
Oh, no one's working at that point, right?
We found someone, but fixed it and got home, so it's fine.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was the first time that I started working with cars and then appreciating like classic cars. I had a couple of other cars besides that. I had a Saab 900 OG Turbo, brilliant car.
Oh, I love that car.
Oh, I love that car too. But it's a piece of shit. It was at least this one.
Yeah.
But in general, I think it's a brilliant car. That four-cylinder engine is just marvelous. How much boost it can handle and the way it works. Like everything is vacuum operated and you remember those switches.
Fuel metering is all, it was all and amazing.
You just turn the switch for the ventilation and it has this noise.
So cool.
It's so cool. Anyways, so moving on that chapter, the real passion was always the boxer engines.
Yeah.
So okay. I missed the Beetle. So I never had a Beetle in my life. Mm. And I sold my Mini Cooper S, which I had at that time. And I said that I have the Range Rover. Now I have to explore my other passion, Porsche. So I was fortunate at that time that I could put some savings together, sold my Mini. And I started looking for my first 911. I never drove a 911 before. I wasn't even sure what I'm going to get into myself. So I had something in my mind as an imagination. And what's your first Porsche? G-Buddy, right?
Everybody. Yeah.
And it's a great start. It was a convertible, which was the cheapest. It was a salvage title in the US. It's not salvage, rebuild title. It had an accident, but it was all right. It's just a two-owner car, low mileage, 7,000 miles, paint to sample, beige interior, blue roof, golden BBS wheels. So it was super attractive, and the price was absolutely stunning. So I said, well, I'm not a convertible guy, but let's try it. This is a moment. And I spoke to the garage that actually did the fix on the accident, and I spoke to the garage that later on did all the maintenances. Stay always in the same Connecticut area where it was bought, and then first owner, second owner, everybody was super sweet. I had all the information, so I got the confidence to get it. It was a lot of money at the time. I think I got it for $20,000+.
Okay, yeah.
And then we flew out with my wife, we picked that up, and everything was, you know, I that was my first time driving it on a test drive. And
what was that like? Was horrible. It what you expected?
It was horrible.
Oh, no.
It was a 915 gearbox.
Oh, okay.
Which was...
A sloppy 915 that's not been looked
after. Yeah, no. This car was sitting for years.
Oh, okay.
And I was also not sure what I'm expecting. So I was expecting something much more modern.
The romanticism of kind of picking up
your But the sound and everything, you know, it was, and the gauges, it's there. Yeah. So we had a 911 and we got a dealer plate. So the seller was kind enough to borrow us a dealer plate. So we drove around 2 weeks in New York.
Nice.
That was Friday again. And we got into a huge thunderstorm. We stopped at New London at the beach just to grab something for dinner.
Mm.
And it was like pouring rain. We got into the car, I turned the key, car was not starting, and then, you know, this ignition pop and car wasn't starting. I didn't even know where the battery is in the car at that time. So I called up the guy, called up the garage. It was a very simple thing, the DMA relay, which is like notorious on this
standard,
car.
Standard. You take one with you on a road trip, right?
Yeah, you have to have one in the glove box. It's a 20 bucks.
You can't find one anywhere, but if you've got one, you're fine. So.
And I said to my wife, I was like, listen, we ordered a flatbed, put it back to the garage where they did the PPI. And the PPI. So, but I said to my wife, listen, I'm 100% sure that it's something because of the rain.
Mm.
So tomorrow when it stops, it dries up, it will start perfectly. So when the car arrived on Monday, they started the car, obviously it was perfectly running fine.
Yeah.
But it was the DMA relay, because it's under the driver's seat, right? So we had a spare one, they've changed it, and that was the first experience with the 911s.
Mm.
So that was the first car. I've learned how to fix it up. I learned in general what the 911 is. I quickly realized that yes, I'm not a convertible guy.
Yeah, fine.
So I sold it and I got a race car out of New York, a G-body, a 3-liter, and SX PCA car.
Okay, cool.
PCA race car. And
relatively recently raced as well, so it was maintained, or was it kind of something?
No, it was a project.
Okay.
It was a project. The seller sold it to me that it's a running project with no issues, but basically, the piston rings were cracked in the engine in two of the cylinders.
Oh, okay. So there was smoking a lot.
Smoking a lot, and there was no compression in it, so it wasn't running well.
Yeah.
And the wiring was all red wires, just red wires.
Oh no.
So we had to figure it out, and I decided to restore it and make it a race car, European spec race car, because that was also the other problem. It wasn't FIA standard.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't be able to.
You couldn't even race
it
anyway.
No. Yeah. So we had to change basically all the safety features. We had to change the roll cage in it. We had to change a lot of stuff to make sure that it's FAA standard and HTP. Actually, I made it into HTP. So that was where the whole building learning curve started on my own with the Porsches. And I had a 964. That I got it from the UK. It's a left-hand drive.
This happens all the time, mate. Don't worry about it. It's all good. I normally leave it in, if especially if someone says something. Don't worry, guys. It's all good.
It's all good.
Carry on.
So I got a 964. That's actually, I bought it from Manchester. It's a left-hand drive.
Yeah, okay.
And it's a Tiptronic. Again, a lot of people will leave you now on the channel, because I think the Tiptronic is a fabulous.
Okay, that's interesting. You have to explain why you think Tiptronic's fabulous.
Because it's not that sloppy that people think. The only thing I would say that it's 4-speed, that's my only concern.
Yeah, okay.
And the rev drops between gear changes, it's annoying.
Yeah.
And if you put it into manual mode, it still change it shifts. It
forces
up,
you to change. Yeah.
That's the two things. If you could, like, you know, keep it in the gear that you select.
Yeah.
I could live with that. And if it would be a 5-speed, that would be even better. But I've really learned driving it.
Yeah, okay, fine.
And 90% I was living in a city and working in a city and driving in a city. Mm. That was my daily driver for 6 years in winter and everything. It was, you know, my daughter grew up in that car.
Oh, that's nice.
And it was really convenient, you know. I could do anything in it. We went for long trips, you know, in the city, in the traffic, taking phone calls, driving around. It was very convenient. So the 964 kind of created the standard benchmark for classic Porsches that I think, usability-wise, what the 964 is still. So that's the standard. And it's very important because everything what we do now with the CAM is kind of relates back to that experience that what that's I've learned from the 964 as a standard of usability. I don't want to get too much more modern from that.
Yeah.
But I think that's the level that kind of we want to cover. Because that's even now, I think it's enough for most of the cases, for most of the people, comparing to modern cars. And I had the race car, which was a devastating project because in Hungary, there's not many people that really understand Porsches. Mm. And there are even less people that understand, oh, I love Lotuses.
That's where I came from, Lotus.
That's a great car.
Yeah, yeah. We'll have a separate conversation about Lotus, mate.
Because it's going to go on, I don't know.
That's my project. It's based on the same chassis as that. So
Yeah.
I spent many, many years in one of those and dailied it as well.
This is a gorgeous car. I've always thought getting one at some point.
You'll have to go for driving it because it is the steering's telepathic.
Yeah.
It's literally, you know that feeling where there's like a deadness to the steering and you put the steering input and it just, you almost wait a little bit for it to do something to hook up.
Really?
Not on those. Those literally, even the slightest adjustment in steering, especially when they've got a decent geo, they are, it's almost like your brain's connected. There's no, it goes from there to there rather than through your hands. It's unreal. There's no steering like it that I've ever found.
The guy who does our ECU optimizations and software, he is a huge Lotus guy as well.
Yeah.
Exige. So I'm very, very much into getting an Exige at some point.
Even if you just spend a bit of time driving one, I think you'll be like,
yeah,
okay, that's rewritten what I think steering feel should be like. But,
oh, and the IMS.
I love and the those IMS as well, yeah.
Oh, we're taking photos of those IMS.
Yeah.
They're so cool,
aren't they? So for those of you, because obviously you listening can't actually see what we're looking at, we've just had a Series 2 Toyota Elise drive past. And there's a couple of IMPs, a red one and a black one, but they're proper.
That's a green one. That's a dark green one. Oh, okay. So beautiful. Both of them.
Straight cut. Oh, it doesn't sound like a straight cut, but they've normally got a straight cut box and they're, very cool. Just going to pause a sec so you can listen to that. There you go. So the race car was a bit of a.
So that was a learning curve. Let's call it that way. And we got to the point where one of our warehouses got freed up from a project that we were shooting. So we were keeping all the assets and wardrobe and everything.
Mm.
And we still had the lease on it. And I said to my partners in my film businesses, like, can I have that, garage for a little bit?
Because
I got kind of like fed up with all the promises and the project wasn't really moving forward that I wanted to have. And I was already like burning a lot of cash. And coming again from the engineering perspective and what I've learned from my dad and from cars, Porsches are not brain science. Mm, so it's not brain surgery. It's not rocket science. It's not something so damn hard to figure it out. So there are books, there are people that you can talk to.
Mm.
So I started educating myself about like 911s, the G-body especially, which I had to, and understanding what's an HTP protocol is, what are the FAA regulations are, what's a homologization, and about the engine. So I started buying books, going online in forums, talking to people, getting acquainted with what it is.
Mm.
And then also started talking in Hungary about with people that I knew that were in the Porsche world, who's referring to who, who's a good engine guy, who's a good gearbox guy, who's in general.
People underestimate how long that takes as well. I mean, it's been 3 years of me doing it now to try and build the right suppliers. And you get some hits and you get some kind of nearly one, that like it might seem like something, but it's not. And if the quality of the CAM cars is so high, every single one of those suppliers or the people you're with has to be a hit, right? You can't kind of have somebody that lets you down because it lets everything down if that happens.
I'll be honest with you. So even when you feel it's right, it's not always right. And it's not always just the vendor's mistake.
Mm.
We do change also sometimes what we are expecting to have.
Okay. Yeah.
And also it's very hard. So managing expectations from both sides, I think it's very hard. If you're not growing up in the car world and you are not professional car builder, like for 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
And that's right for the vendor because he's just a supplier for a certain part.
Yeah.
But when you are coming into the picture and you have a vision and you want to describe that vision, how is envisioned by you and by him, it's different.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where the misunderstandings and sometimes the stress and the tension comes out, even the best ones. So yeah. It's hard. I think it's...
And especially, I think the other bit that happens as well is that you build relationships up with these people. So giving feedback to somebody that you've built a friendship up with, but it's business at the end of the day, and they've put time and energy in something, and it isn't what you asked for, or there's a difference that you need, a change that needs to be made. That can fracture friendships depending on kind of the way that goes.
100%. And it goes both ways.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So trying to, you know, navigating that space, it's complicated. And Hungary is a small country, so everybody knows about everybody.
Yeah.
And again, finding the right people, obviously it was not coming from the Porsche world. So I was looking into motorsports guys and restoration guys. And then I was trying to find someone that had like a bit of a motorsports background and, you know, went through and went towards to restoration or the opposite. So had enough from restoration and was interested in motorsports. We had to kind of find those people that were willing to learn and educate themselves on the special things that the Porsches have. But at the end of the day, since our cars are based on a 912, we build our rules.
We
build our expectations and we build our technical guidelines, what we need to achieve. So we have a bit of a freedom on that. And also, we're also at the same time stricter. So it's, you learn something how it's done on a 912 that doesn't apply to us 100%. Mm. In some cases it is, but most of the cases are not.
Yeah.
And the biggest problem is what we do is, you know, it's not a restoration and it's a modification. It's not 100% motorsports. So motorsports people are performance orientated and not precision orientated.
Yeah. It goes fast and it's got some duct tape on it, but it's faster. That's it.
Yeah. So they don't care. It needs to do that 30 minutes of the race. Yeah. It has to hold the beacon, the engine, everything, suspension, brakes. It will all work, but it won't look nice.
Yeah. People, again, I think people don't get that, is the you build, you know, building race cars, you build it to the spec of the series, and you're looking for all the loopholes to be able to make sure that your car is the fastest.
Yep.
Everybody else is trying to do the same. If you can cut corners and get there, and you potentially shave off some time, that's what you do.
Yep.
But when you've got a client that wants to use that car and they're not interested in racing, they want to take it out on a Sunday, to be reliable, to look amazing, they've got a totally different set of aspirations, right?
And then there comes restoration. So, you know, these people, when you go there and you tell them that, well, you know, this interior panel doesn't look nice because it doesn't, you know, the gaps are not even or so. And then, you know, they come back to you, it's like, well, but this is how it looks original. This is how it was in 66.
Mm.
And then you tell them, it's like, I understand that this is how it looks in 66. But we are not in 1966.
Our
expectations is different.
So
let's figure out how to make it better. And this is the conflict where you get from the restoration people and from the motorsports people. So you have to find a very small group of people that is willing to do quality work based on a 66 or 67, like on an old car.
Mm.
With the mindset and the technology in engineering from the highest motorsports level.
Yeah.
And that's the most complicated part.
And I think that sets out the difference between, and I'm not going to mention the companies because I don't want to talk badly about any company, but the guys that are doing it really well, and it's fairly obvious that they're doing it really well. I was speaking to Rob Dickinson last weekend, and obviously Singer have kind of got that same kind of perspective of, right, their motto is everything's important, right? And I think you carry that into kind of every design detail. And if you do that religiously, you're going to get a great product. But the problem is when you get some people that are modifying cars or developing cars, but they don't have that same, they want the look or they want the performance, but they don't have that same obsessive attention to detail. You end up with something that is close, but it's never going to feel right. It's never going to feel perfect. And I get, and I'm blowing smoke up your ass a little bit here, Mickey, but your cars, when I see them, they look perfect. And that is a, that's a...
We're getting there,
yeah.
Obviously. So I think each car that we're pushing out, it's for the team. And we have a fabulous team right now. So like really good team. It was very hard and it was a very difficult journey, but each individual guy deserves a, you know, a handshake or a clap or gratitude, because everybody puts something onto the table comes from a world where the cars are important to them, and what they do is definitely, you know, a, without those experiences and backgrounds and knowledges, it would be a different product.
Mm.
So they're trying to put my vision into a real world car that is appreciated and will work in at clients. So we have already 6 cars in build, and all of the cars are all corners of the world, far. Which is cool from one side, but from logisticals, it's a nightmare.
Well, I picked up a client that I start work with on Monday from Thailand.
Yeah.
So I've got the kind of, and I'm just starting that kind of the conversation on Monday to kind of go, well, let's talk about scope and everything. So, but it's the first one outside of the country and it couldn't be further away, right? It's literally...
And Thailand is complicated because of the registration and importing
right
now.
They've got a car there. I'm project managing it and kind of doing design, but they're going to manage it practically from there. So I have no control over... you know, who they use, but I will be liaising with the companies and
gotcha.
So there's a lot to do, but so
you have some very good friends from Thailand. We had the guys that were doing the big epic road trip, so they were passing through Hungary and Budapest. I know Tens there.
Okay. Yeah.
And so he was the lead of the group, and then Stefan Bauer for the Curves magazine was there too. So it was a good couple of days with the guys when they were in Budapest. So anyways, so the cars are all in different corners. So, you know, if something happens, it's always a problem how you can manage that with the client and how you handle it. So there is one car in Seattle, there is another one in Miami, there is another one in Brisbane, there is one in Singapore. So you can't just deal with all of that. So the cars need to be better than anything, right? Not just for the client, it's for our sake as well.
Of course, yeah.
So that's definitely a reliability issue that it's so important that it's probably the most important for us at the moment.
Just, I feel like we've jumped from kind of the race car almost straight into kind of today. So let's get back to the kind of the inception of the company and kind of, you've obviously spent some time around some, you know, some good cars and some development cars. There's a Mark II Golf just going past and a 944. Anyway, did you wake up one morning and go, you know what? I want to build something of my own that's better than all of this stuff I'm seeing and then a 912. Like, give me a quick summary as to kind of...
So you mentioned Singer.
Yeah.
I was lucky to see Singer in 2014.
Right, okay.
Not the old... workshop.
Yeah.
Seamus walked us around on a Friday afternoon after work before going on to airport. We were like sneaking in on the Google Maps address and
already?
And that was their dismantling part, and they were like,
oh, okay, that's cool.
What's here? And then Seamus was about to leave. And he's like, what are you doing guys here? It's like, well, you know, we are enthusiasts.
That's
from
so
Hungary,
cool.
And we're just like, is there any way? It's like, oh God.
Fine.
We're leaving like literally 3 hours and flying out. We were just hoping to have a sneak peek, and it was super grateful. I drove on it. Listen, you don't, no cameras, no phones, nothing. You've seen nothing. You don't talk about it. We drove around.
I mean, 11 years later, we could talk about it. But
I guess it's a cool story now. Hope he won't get into trouble.
Fine.
So he drove us around to a different warehouse from that one, probably. And he showed the whole project, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
So it was just mind blowing for me. It was so far from, like, you know, thinking at some point that, you know, I will be doing something similar. Because the Singer is so much at their game ahead of everybody. I think it will be always kind of like a appreciation and motivation for all of us who is in the
game. Honestly, I got Rob to sign the inside of my hood because I was like, you know, he could see bits of my car that are kind of tips of the hat to his work. I think it embarrasses him a little bit to know that people feel like that about it. But I think you're right, you know, like the singer and then there's
everybody else.
Everyone else. And so then that stack is different, but
So for me, it was huge, especially because Rob, like you said, the attention to details, the design. And for me, the design was always very important. How it looks like, the proportions. I've seen many modified cars. You've seen many modified cars, but the proportions and all together, how it was packaged, formed, you haven't seen anything close to what a Zinger was like. So, I mean, Zinger didn't invent backdating. There were backdated cars.
Yeah.
Zinger didn't invent resto mods. There were resto mods before.
Yeah.
What Zinger created is a product that people wanted to have.
Yeah.
From backdates and resto mods at the same time. They just figured it out what is actually sexy. And it worked. And I'm sure Rob would say that the road was very bumpy.
Oh, he did.
And that last 20
years
for them, it was very complicated. And I'm pretty sure from the distance, it seems very easy for them because now they sell so many cars and they have a reputation and the prices of their cars are skyrocketing. So it's collectible already. But I think they had to work for that and deserve that and get into that point. And
he was even saying now is that people have got this kind of expectation of him being a billionaire living on a private island, and the reality is he's still at the desk grinding away, right? And it's still, I mean, that's reasonable expectation, is that despite the cars costing millions, it doesn't instantly make you a kind of billionaire overnight to do this stuff.
If anybody, your listener, like, you know, listeners want or think about starting a car business, they should think twice. It's not a lucrative business.
No,
I tell you.
No.
It's a passion.
Yeah.
It gives you a lot of joy, a lot of tears, a lot of blood and sweat.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, if this is your passion, you should do it. But
if anyone's listening to this and they're like me and you saying, you know, do or don't do it, it's not going to make a difference to them. If they've set their mind and their heart on, I'm going to be the next Cam or the next whoever, they're going to do it anyway, right?
Don't do it for the money. Do it for any other reason.
I'm saying
if you want to do it for the business, because it seems like a lucrative business, it's not true. It's fake. It's absolutely unreal. So don't do it for the money. Do it for your own sake.
To be a creative, to be an engineer.
Do something that express yourself. It's an how you express yourself. I think that's the important about it. It's also a self-expression.
That'll keep you at it as well, because the money won't get you up in the morning.
You know,
that morning where you're fed up and you've had an argument with your other half or your kids are screaming or whatever, it's the passion and being a creative or being an engineer that will want you, that'll take you to those places and be like, cool.
Right.
But if money is the motivation and getting you up each morning,
don't do it for the money. I mean, especially this business, it's not going to work from the money point of view. Mm. You have to have a lot of patience, and really you have to understand that the challenges, you can't really foresee all of them. You can prepare for a lot of things, but you can't foresee everything.
Mm.
And you just have to play with it and play it by the ear, and you figure it out, and you have to, you know, cool. Even sometimes when you lose a lot of money, like, it feels like a waste, but it's a lesson that you learn.
Mm.
And everything gets into the builds some way or another.
Yeah.
If it makes any sense.
Of course it does. Yeah.
So at the end of the day, I think it's a great thing to do. It's a very good, you know, way to express yourself if you're into cars and technology and engineering, but don't do that for the money. So back to the question, it's going to be hard, but we're teasing. So I had this race car, I figured it out, I made the car, I went on Hungaroring for a test drive, I drove it, I went into the gravel, I came out and I said, totally devastated, because I had to repaint basically the floor again.
Mm.
Because I had a brake issue or something like that. I don't remember. It doesn't matter. I fixed it, fixed the car, everything. I said, like, you know what? I was racing at the time on a 325 challenges with E30s. great cars, but that's what we had locally as a club race around that time. And I think when we finished the car, I went out to the Hungaroring ring, had a bit of a fun with it. That's when I actually realized that I enjoyed more the process of figuring out and building a great car. Mm. And as soon as I went out to the track and I felt that this is fucking cool, this is a great car, yeah. I'm done. What's next?
Okay, cool.
It felt a little bit empty. You see my point?
Okay, interesting. Yeah, so
it was an excitement when I didn't know how to figure it out. I don't know, HTP protocol, the paperwork, FEA, how we get the engine running and so on. So all the complications. And when the car was finally running and it was nice, I kind of felt, and now what? I have a cool car. Am I going out racing? Maybe, but I enjoyed so much more the whole process. So.
Yeah, okay.
So I put it on Bring a Trailer. No, P Car Market. It was on P Car Market. And I sold the car to Austria to a gentleman. And I never heard of him since. Maybe it's, I don't know, it's a bad order.
Drop info at reengineering.com. If you're that guy that bought that car off Mickey, send me an email and tell me what it looks like now and I'll send the details on.
Well, yeah, so that was it. And then I had the cash from there. I still had my 964. And I kind of was thinking that what's next? I always loved the short wheelbase car. Mm-hmm. Again, going back to the original talk where we had about the simple design with three lines.
Yeah.
I think the short wheelbase original 911, 912 is the simplest and the nicest from all of the 911s.
Of course, I agree. Yeah.
I like the narrow body. I like the short wheelbase.
Yeah.
Everything is just so small and tiny in that car. I really like the simple interior. I like the simplicity of that car. It's so great. The proportion, everything is just beautiful. It handles horrible, the 911 especially, with those like big engines in the back, obviously. The brakes were, again, horrible. But I thought, so when I went to Peterson and I went down to their vault. Should we go to another?
It might
spot?
Be worth going to the right to the back.
Yeah, let's go
let's
there.
Let's take a walk because it's bless these guys. They're enjoying themselves, and I don't want to interrupt them. We'll tell them to be quiet. No. It's not for us to do that. So
because it wouldn't be fair.
No, it wouldn't. That's true.
So
yes, carry on, mate.
So I went to LA with my buddy, and we went to Peterson, and we went down to the vault, like this world tours that they have, and they have those cars that are not on the exhibition. And there was a 911R, the 67. I was lucky to see three already in my life, three different ones.
Yeah.
And for me, the 67R conceptually was the, and is probably my favorite 911s from all time.
Yeah.
From all time. Because that's what a simple race car concept is.
Yeah.
You know, get rid of the weight, put the strongest motor that you have on the shelf, and that's your race car, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was it. And I really love the story about it. And I'm very unfortunate that, you know, it wasn't a successful program and they killed it pretty soon. And then the
that's
SD,
what makes it a unicorn.
It makes a unicorn, but it basically the concept and the idea bit later on moved over to the RS and the SDs. So it was well worth. And to be honest, the R wasn't a great car as a race car itself. It was a first generation, but the concept, the visuals, the aesthetics are really like that. Like, you know, the tractor indicators and the lights in the back. So they didn't give a shit about anything. It was just so functional. It was amazing. And I love that. And I love the 60s race cars. I love that kind of era. I like the visuals. I like the liveries. I love the simple tiny wheels.
Yeah.
No big brakes. Although I love the 934s and 935s with the big turbos and the Kramers and everything. Total different era. Total different mindset. Total different approach. But, you know, you got to start somewhere. So I thought that initially, I wanted to build a 911R recreation
tribute for myself.
And then when I was fiddling with the idea, then I realized that the whole concept in that car, everything is so simple and easy. The idea is, and the most important part is the engine.
Yeah.
So if I just put any kind of 911 engine and just visually I'll do a 911R, then it's not what it is, right? It's a very bad fake. I need to create an engine that is a 906 engine. Okay, I'll do a 906 engine. But then it's a race engine. That means that I'm not going to use it because you have to rev it up.
10,000 mile rebuilds. It's like, who's going
to
do that?
Who's going to do that? And it doesn't make any sense to create a race engine for a car that I want to actually use. So here is the quetch. Let's do a car that is short wheelbase, narrow body, lightweight, conceptually the 911R, but it's drivable. So I can take my daughter to school, pick up and get to an ice cream, go for an ice cream, go to a track day, enjoy myself, go to work, really an all purpose like what a 911 was designed. Because I think still you can't really say another different brand that is so much an all around car.
There isn't anything that doesn't give you the same level of performance and enjoyability, I don't think. Because take that Lotus again. I mean, I drove one daily for 4 years and I hated it at the end. I loved the car, but I hated the experience of owning it because it didn't do what a 911 does, which is you can go to work in it, you can go shopping in it, pick your daughter up in it, go to the racetrack in it. Like, it doesn't do all of those things.
I went with those in a Home Depot.
Yeah, I put panels in it.
And I remember I had a sunroof.
I had a massive strip of MDF in the back of my Cayman, right?
So, exactly. You know, piles of sticks were hanging out of the sunroof. So that was literally, I made holes on the roof just because I wasn't careful loading in and out. The whole paint was scratched because I put the box on it and it was dirty and I moved it. So, you know, I abused that car. And it gave me so much pleasure and you know, memories and experiences that none other car that I had. And obviously we can say BMWs, but BMWs in general are not like that.
So that's the concept, a 911R with a usable, you know, power plant that's going to have some longevity, so you can actually get more than 10,000 miles out of it before rebuilding it, but still needs to feel light and nimble and all
it's
the great
simple.
Stuff.
But needs, and let's go back to the 964 idea. To create a level of comfort that is comparable to a 964 standard.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
You can, it can be simple, it can be easy, but I need air conditioning, man. It's like we are living in a world where it's hot and I don't want to sweat in the car. It doesn't make me feel good when I'm just sweating through my shirt and get out. It's just, it doesn't make any sense. It limits myself of driving when I drive that car. Some people want a stereo. We have a stereo in the car. I'll be honest, I don't care. If I'm on my own, I just put my AirPods in it, and probably that's the best way to do it. I still hear the sound of the engine and everything, and can listen to music if that's what I want. But in general, you know, how you drive it, the seat position, the seats, everything, the functionality has to be a level at a 964-ish is.
Okay. So we've got the concept dialed in now.
Yes.
And then, I mean, there's a huge step between having an idea and then turning it into a profitable business. So,
well, profit is that, right. let's leave that out.
Okay. Let's skip that bit.
Just a business. Yeah. Just a business.
An operating business.
That's nice
generating
way to put it. Yeah.
Something of an income, whether that's matching its outgoings, who knows, but you've got to start somewhere, right?
So yeah, you have to start somewhere. So I bought a 912. Because that's a donor, it's the easiest and cheapest one. So I drove around with a donor car.
Californian car, or?
I think it was a California. Yes, it was. Originally, it was a U.S. car. And then it had it had British plates.
Oh, okay.
It had a V5, and it still has a V5,
oh,
and
so
it's already English. It's registered again in England.
Is that the green one then?
Yeah, it's a green one.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, Irish green, origin color, lovely 68. So I bought it in Hungary from a friend. As a project, restoration project, I drove around with it, and I was pretty much amazed that the 912 itself is an original car, how much better it is compared to a short wheelbase 911. And some people would say that I'm maybe not true, but the balance is better, handling is better. The 90 horsepower is not much, sure, but with those brakes, what you know, the brakes are the same basically, suspension is the same.
Yeah.
It's only the engine is literally what's different. For the 90 horsepower, that car is balanced. It's much more well thought than a 911. The 911 is over-engined compared to the rest of the car. It doesn't feel right over there too much. It just doesn't work. The 912 corners nicely. It brakes nicely. It's a great classic. If you really, if anybody wants to have a great classic car from the 60s, a Porsche, buy a 912. 100%. If the only thing that you have to get used to it is the sound of a Beatles-ish kind of
thing. It's got its own charm.
It has its own charm. And what I never really liked is how the looks of the engine. It's really like a Beetle, and it's very disappointing when you open it up and there's this empty big place and there's this strange
tinware,
whatever it is. You don't get it. It feels like it's a wrong engine swap.
Yeah, yeah.
So the visuals are not right for me.
Yeah.
But some people like it. Anyways, so the 912 is a great car, 100%. I agree. And I think a lot of other people will say the same thing. Prices are going up, so for the 912s, and I think it's right. It was always kind of like an underdog. This is also what I always loved about it. And I kind of like the appreciation of being an underdog because, you know, we are coming from Eastern Europe, Hungary. We're not the typical car places. So we can consider ourselves not the typical, you know, obvious car people. We are kind of like the 912. You know, you're not expecting it a performance or like a thought out collectible car. There's so many others that you wouldn't mention. So it seemed the right, but not the obvious choice for me to start. So I got the car, I drove around, I kind of liked it, and then I started thinking, how would I do that concept? How would I turn into this idea? And I had many ideas of the engine. I had the 986 Boxster as a concept. I thought at some point that I would put the full drivetrain, engine, suspension in it. Pretty much the same way like now the 914 1511 is.
Yeah.
I had the idea this, you know, doing that with the 912, but then said that it's going to be a modern car.
It does if yeah.
Yeah, so it has to be an air cooled. Then if I put any kind of 911 engine into it, air cooled engine, it's been done 100% times. It's going to be a 912 6.
Yeah.
There's not much difference, nothing.
What's going to stand you apart?
Yeah, nothing. And then, obviously, I've looked into all the air-cooled four-cylinder engines.
Oh, and to do it well? I mean, it's so expensive to do it well.
You know, you can go with the Beetle engines, the Type 1, the Type 4s. The Type 4 at least has some sort of route to Porsche with the 914 and the 912E. That's actually a brilliant four-cylinder boxer engine.
But the maximum you can get out of that's what, 150, 160 brake horsepower?
No. Oh, that's a amazing engine. You can go up to 3.1 liter. There's
can
kits.
You really? Is it?
There's so many kits for that.
Wow, I did not know that.
That's also
limited.
For the T3 buses.
Oh, right, okay.
So 2.7,
two point. Small bore and a big block.
Amazing! You can turbocharge. You can do whatever with it. Great engine. It's the best conceptual as a block and everything. It's probably one of the best pushrod four cylinder.
Wow! There you go.
So, but that's again, that would be the obvious choice to swap it, and an easy way to do it. And I started thinking and in formalizing my idea. So. My idea was, everybody has his own version of what a resto mod is. For me, it was a modern classic. So originally when I started this whole project, I wanted to have a classic car that I would be loving to drive and use. Something that I would not to take that hassle of an old classic car. So it starts, it stops, it has the comforts that I need, not more, not less. I still have the analog drive. I still have the feeling that I'm driving a 60s car, but on a different standard.
Yeah.
It's closer to a standard, to a modern car. So if I get out of my modern car and get into my modern classic, the difference, the gap is not so far. So I would dislike or be uncomfortable in that classic car. Because what I feel nowadays, and I spoke to generation younger than me. Is, you know, people don't get that, don't have that kind of relationship to older cars. They already grown up in the 90s. Cars from the 90s are so modern. There is not much of difference between today's cars and the 90s cars. But from the 90s cars to the 60s cars,
it's huge.
It's huge. And if you don't have that kind of history through your parents or your childhood, or just simply just because you like it and you've been around it, you see the object, early 911, they're gorgeous. You buy one and you get just simply put it in the garage and you'll be scared to drive it because, you know, you're overfueling, the choke and the carburetors and the jets.
Kids wouldn't, I don't mean this respectfully, but kids wouldn't even, or most kids wouldn't know what a choke is, let alone...
Carburetor.
Yeah, with the carburetor, you know, balancing jets and things like that. Yeah, this is all stuff that they would have no idea
about. No idea. And then, so you're there with this whole situation, and then what are you going to do? So you have to create something that is closing the bridge, or actually bridging this gap. And this was my concept. So I wanted to keep the original car as much as possible. And if, let's say, the idea, if Porsche would do a 912 recreation now, how would they do it? So keep everything.
It's so interesting because the Ren 550, so my 550 project. That's where I started. If Porsche were going to make a 550 Spider now, what would they do?
Exactly.
That's exactly the same style.
I think it's one way to do it.
There's many ways to do it. Yeah, yeah.
But this was my idea. So our cars, if the donor car is matching numbers, it will stay matching numbers. So we have that 616 engine. We have that 901 gearbox. We have that suspension. And then obviously we do a lot of modifications to all to those, but they still stay original. So the 616 is 616, the 901 is a 901. The suspension elements and components, the Vishbones and everything are the same. Okay, the dampers are different. It's not torsion, it's four corner coilovers. But anyways, so that was the general idea. And then we started with the 912. So we dismantled, we got this 912, we started copying the body and learning how to, where to get the body parts for the carbon fiber.
You'd research composites at this point and kind of figured out you wanted to use carbon fiber and you wanted to...
Well, I knew that I didn't want to do fiberglass.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I hate fiberglass. I don't know, it always reminds me of bathtub.
I think it's two steps away from a Covin or something like that, you know? And no one wants that, right?
So for me, it was straight from the very beginning, it was carbon fiber. If you're already doing composite work, then it should be carbon fiber. Yeah. So there's no point doing something different. And then I started reaching out to companies and seeing what's already available for short wheelbase. There weren't really many companies doing anything for the short wheelbase. Usually it was the 911 R kits.
Yeah, okay.
I got some parts, but unfortunately I realized that the quality is just not there.
They're not designed
To be turned car. Into
it. Yeah, exactly. They're project cars for somebody at a weekend to do, maybe, or a race car again. But there's a huge gap between production and selling a thing that is a product.
All these fiberglass parts or carbon fiber parts that you can buy off the shelf, they don't fit.
No.
You have to make them fit if you can make them fit. And then obviously, like you said, these are project cars. So if the door gaps are not perfect, who cares?
Yeah.
Nobody.
Yeah.
You don't care. Nobody cares. You just wanted to have a cool car. That's fine. Those things are...
That is cool.
That's cool for yourself.
Yeah.
So, but it wasn't good enough for me. It wasn't good enough for us. So we started doing it. And then that's where I met my engineer partner, Shandor, who started doing the composite work, helping out with that composite work. So we started, he built already an E9 and a couple of other cars already in composite, full composite. So he knew the technology. He knew what we were trying to do and how we're going to achieve what we are achieving nowadays. So we started doing the first sets of molds of the car and the first sets of carbon panels. Obviously, again, like he already did a couple of projects before, but as we progressed, we learned. Getting off something from a modern car as a standard. Modern cars are much more standardized. 60s Porsches, they're all different.
Yeah, yeah.
No, not even the 90s. I mean, I remember Seamus in Zinger told me once that they had trouble in the beginning when they realized that actually even the 964 cars, were the panels were matched together in the factory. So when you dismantle them and you mix match the parts, it's very hard to get the same gaps back to where it was. So unless you really need to change the panel, it's better to keep what it was,
the original panel original for that car.
That car. Yeah, yeah. Because they were actually at factory coming like that.
Yeah.
And that's even more true to the older cars.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I remember my car had almost 2 centimeter difference between the floor on one side and the other side, and it was factory floor.
Wow.
So many of those stories.
So, I mean, that alone makes it difficult to turn into a production model.
Yeah.
Because you, if you're producing, you know, carbon fiber panels, they'll be produced to a spec and repeatable. You can't be like, I'm going to custom that one and it needs to be a kind of slightly different shape there. You'd never be able to do it.
Never, never. And this is what's probably the biggest learning curve was for us.
Mm.
So this is what we learned, and then body work. So now we have to standardize the restoration of the body, the shell.
Yeah, yeah.
So our shells need to match.
Yeah.
Because otherwise the panels won't fit.
Yeah.
So this was probably the biggest learning curve.
How long did that take before, you know, to go from that kind of point where you were...
2 years.
2 years. That's quick.
2 years.
Wow.
Well, that's basically four sets of cars.
Wow, yeah.
So we did that twice on our prototype car. Maybe a little bit more than 2 years. It's actually three.
Three is quick, dude.
So I would say that our first client car is also, let's consider it in a way, a production prototype car.
Yeah.
Or zero series. It's production spec in all means, but we had to learn on that car a lot on finalizing the body.
So whoever that client is, massive credit to you for kind of
absolutely
getting involved and kind of believing in CAM and believing in you and the team.
All clients deserve it, because every client is a huge ambassador and supporter for CAM.
Yeah.
So everybody is super relaxed, supportive, helpful. I mean, the car we are having here right now in Bicester, that's a client car too.
Yeah.
So we don't have a demo car at the moment present, because we're building constantly the client cars. And every client in Miami, Carlos, handed over the keys every time we needed it for show purposes or just demo it for the press.
Yeah, they're more than happy to do it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So
kudos, guys. Huge. Well done.
They're great guys, everyone. Josef, who's the owner of this car, he said the same thing. Listen, do whatever you need to do, show it to whoever you need to show, and then you just bring it over in September. That's it.
What a hero.
Yeah, absolutely. So without those guys, it wouldn't be able to do what we are doing it. And so figuring out the body part, it was 3 years, and we're still learning. And it's getting better and better. Every car is way better. Like, obviously, we see these details under the skin. Mm-hmm. From the outside, it's very hard to judge, but there are mistakes, like everywhere. It's handmade, hand-built cars with a lot of love and attention. And with all the care, it's still, we see flaws that we try to fix it as we can. Oh, wrong way.
Because I was about to say, it's like... Just total also
he was
pilot.
So confident in going this way. It's like wrong way.
So again, for those of you listening, there's a German car that kind of just comes straight past the wrong way around the car park, because they're thinking they're at home still. But anyway, they didn't crash into one, so they're all right. But
exactly. So that was one part, and then every part. So each component needs a minimum of 4 or 5 iterations to get where we are right now, and I think each of these components will get an update soon.
Okay, that's interesting.
Based on the usage and the information that we get from the clients.
That's perfect, yeah.
But those are like, this new update is more kind of like an update. So it's not like an iteration, it's more just, you know, learning from and getting the feedbacks from the drivers and understanding and trying to adjust it's more my fine tuning and tweaking rather than and creating something new. But obviously, at the same time, we're constantly trying to figure out new stuff.
Of course, yeah, evolving and
evolving.
Looking forward.
We're working on a new model. So there's a 912C, and now we have the 912T, which we will be releasing next week.
That's so cool.
The 912T is a touring spec from the C. So you see, this one is the full carbon. This is the only from the outside. This is the only metal part. This is for the semi carbon.
Yeah,
and this is the T.
Gotcha. Love it, mate. And I love the again, you're a man after my own heart. The Colin Chapman quote: "Simplify, then add lightness." Which is,
this is so how true. We live.
You improve everything by removing weight.
Yep. You don't need that big brakes. You don't need that big wheels. You don't need, you know, a lot of stuff just because you don't have that weight in your car. So yeah,
love it. So that's the journey.
That's the journey.
Wow. You should be incredibly proud, both on the whole team.
Thank you. Well, you know, it's very hard from the inside, but seeing the appreciation for people, that helps a lot.
Yeah. Literally. And like I said, you know, I've been chasing a conversation with you for at least 2 years and coming off the back of a conversation with Rob Dickinson a week ago or 2 weeks ago, whenever it was. And then finally
I never met him. Hopefully I'm going to see him.
He's around, or was around. He's probably gone back to Cali now, but he was obviously over for Goodwood. So,
yeah.
But super chill guy. Super chill guy.
At one point.
I'm sure. He'll be aware of what you're doing. He was very ear to the ground. He knows everything that's going on in the industry. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I've got his email address. I'll ping him an email.
Tell him.
Did you know, by the way, listen to this, mate.
Miki is a big fan of you and your work. Yeah, you can tell him. Absolutely.
Yeah, I will do. And I'll because I said that I'd send renders over of the 550 that I'm building, we're going to start building, because he was interested in that. But they're very similar in philosophy between what I'm going to build and what you've done. So, Miki, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much as well.
Big thanks for creating some time at the last minute to have this conversation.
It's fine. It's our pleasure.
Yeah. And hopefully the next time you come and do a press session in the UK, I'll get a chance to sit in the car and have a look around it properly.
We'll figure it out.
Work something out. Cool. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you have, then you can rate and review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you've got any questions, you can pop that in the Spotify chat. And I'll get in touch with Miki and ask any of those questions that come through. For now, though, thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode. What a lovely guy. And these are all different, these conversations. Some of them, it feels like you have to work quite hard and it's an interview. And I don't love those. That's not necessarily a knock of any individual. Just sometimes you click and sometimes the atmosphere is more formal, which sets the conversation up to be more formal, and then some of them are kind of more two guys having a drink, having a chat, and that was definitely one of those. I much prefer these conversations because they allow for you to you as the listener to just kind of get closer to what that person's thinking and feeling as they build these companies and design these cars. I got lucky with Richard Tuthill as an example, where he was really willing to kind of be open and sort of talk about his personal situations and his youth and things, but not all of them are like that. And yeah, so it's testament to Miki, testament to his kind of relaxed nature and atmosphere, and you know, probably just being outside and it being an on the hoof thing, as I've used hoof twice, I'm going to keep with it. Whereas some of them, they take months to organize, so it just goes to show. And I think this is bizarrely, considering it was the least prep in terms of setting the actual chat at all, that it's come out as one of the best. So I hope you enjoyed it as well. I hope you've got lots of nice plans for this weekend, and I'll see you back next week. I've got a couple of options for next week, still mulling over which one, so I'm not sure which one I'm going to go with it yet. But either way, there will be an episode out next week and it'll be another feature. So look after yourselves, take it easy. Make sure if you're going out for a drive, you hopefully have some aircon. If you don't, then good luck. I'll see you soon. Take care for now. Bye bye.